I believe it's very telling that when Satan used the serpent and made his approach to Eve and so to get to Adam, that at no point did Satan begin to try to question the existence of God at the beginning. Instead, what we find and discover is that when Satan made his approach using the serpent, as we read in Genesis, that there was not a denial of the existence of God, but rather there was an undermining of the authority and of the accuracy of God's holy and precious word. And I certainly encourage you to come along tomorrow as our brother Dennison will come to speak about the word of God itself and its authority and the necessity for it in the first place. You see, Satan knew that to deny the existence of God to Adam and Eve in the state of their perfection, in that condition of paradise when sin had not entered the world or into their lives at that particular point, to deny the existence of God and say to Adam and to Eve that God does not exist would be a most foolish thing to do. Well, why? Because all around Adam and Eve was the beauty and the majesty of an unmarred and an unaffected creation. And to deny the existence of God would be a most foolish and a most unwise thing. And yet here we are today, many hundreds and thousands of years after that momentous and pivotal occasion in the first things of Holy Scripture, and where do we find ourselves? Well, look, we know where we find ourselves. We know what our society is like, and we know what our world is like, and we know that we live in particular in a Western civilization, that we live in an environment where atheism and the rejection of an all-powerful and self-existent God is that which is continually rejected, and it has built momentum. What often concerns me even more than the rise of atheism in any particular day and age is actually the rise of indifference. And side by side, you have two of these things causing great damage and harm. You've got the atheistic mindset. You've got that view and that conviction of people who believe that there is no God and there has been no God. And yet side by side, you've got the prevalence of a thinking in the hearts and minds, especially in the lives of young people, where they have no thought either way to any of these things. They simply have not given any thought to the existence of God, whether God exists or in their view, God does not exist. And so all the great need there is this evening to address what is a foundational question in many respects. And while I would not say that as we look at these questions this week that any one of them is going to be more important than the other, what I will say this evening is that we must begin with the existence of God, because when we begin with the existence of God, then we have the foundation for everything else that is going to follow by way of these meetings. And so we have to get this right. And we need all the help of God to get this right as we look at the Holy Scriptures. Now, what I want to also say before I go any further is that it is important for us to remember that being convinced of the existence of God is not the same thing as being converted to faith in Jesus Christ. And I cannot emphasize that enough this evening. We may leave a meeting like this, and of course I speak to many, if not all of you, that do believe in the existence of God, and if this encourages you and it strengthens you in your faith, and that certainly has been something of my prayer for the message and for the meetings, then God has answered prayer. But hypothetically, in a sense, if we come into a meeting like this, not quite sure of the existence of God, question marks over what we believe or don't believe, and we leave the meeting maybe more convinced about the existence of God, that doesn't make us a child of God. It doesn't make us a Christian. There is an even more greater and thorough and necessary work that must take place, namely conversion to faith in Jesus Christ and being born of the Spirit of God. And I want to make that abundantly clear so I'm not misunderstood this evening as I go through this particular message. However, starting with the existence of God is fundamental, absolutely crucial. And maybe your testimony is something like my testimony. I know at the age when the Lord was pleased to save me, this was one of the many things that the Lord used to convince me and show me that I do stand before a mighty God. It was something I gave very little thought to, if no thought to. And it, as loved ones and those that were faithful to my soul began to pray for me and began to show me things by which there was a convincing of God's existence before my life, that was the means and something of the door by which God was pleased to save me. And you know what? That testimony is the testimony of countless individuals. And what a glorious thing it would be, whether it's this week, whether in the weeks to come, whether it's our fellowship, or whether it's other Christian fellowships outside of ours who preach the gospel, oh, there would be a revival and a surge in our days where even the people of God are so convinced and assured of God who reigns on high, that there is a new thrust and passion in their souls for the lives of men and women. Because what I say this evening is maybe very similar to what I was saying to the men yesterday at the men's conference, that when we grasp things like this, really we are quite different. Our God reigns on high, and he is the mighty God. So where do we begin with this sort of behemoth of a subject? Well, what I want us to do is this. I want us to first of all consider how the existence of God is demanded. How the existence of God is demanded. Now, I read from Job chapter 38 for a reason, and I think a good reason at that. Job was not an atheist. We all know that this evening. I think we all know that as we look at this book and we know something of this man in the scriptures. And far from being an atheist, he was one of the prominent and earliest of the saints of God. He was a man who lived near to God, and he was a man who feared God. And he was sort of almost in a sense head and shoulders above everyone else in his community. But we know that as we read the life of Job and this portion of scripture, that we find a man that was very soon beset with troubles of a nature that would overwhelm the best of us this evening. Now, we know this story well, so you don't need me to run through it in great detail, because Job's initial response was a good response. The Lord hath given, the Lord hath taken away, and so forth. What a wonderful testimony. But along came individuals that were seeking to be his friends. And well, they came with their words, they came with their counsel, they came with their advice. But when you reach the end of Job's book and you read how God evaluates these individuals, it is God who says that these men have not spoken the things that were right. They may well have stated truth on occasions, but it was not truth for the occasion. And it was not the truth for that moment. And so Job found himself in dark and lonely and very difficult places where he began to question why these things were taking place. And very soon Job began to regret the day of his own birth. And so Job found himself in a very difficult place. What was it that brought Job out of that place? It was the existence of God. Do you realize that? What was it that recovered Job from such a lonely and a very trying set of circumstances? It's right before your eyes in chapter 38 when the Lord answers out of his majestic whirlwind. He's not speaking as dust of the earth. He speaks from heaven itself. And as he thunders from heaven down to the life of Job, what is it we read in verse 4? Job, where were you? Job, where were you when I laid the foundations of this earth? Well, the answer is quite an easy answer, isn't it? Job was not there. Job and no one else was there. And Job was not able to answer that question because he had no knowledge of that occasion, because he was not there. But God was. Now, I know that when I make a statement of that nature, that those that will reject the existence of God, who claim to be atheistic or something of a similar persuasion, well, they would object to that particular stage and say, well, you just can't say that God was there. Well, we can, because this is what the scripture is saying. And what I want to argue this evening on the back of that is that the very presence of the universe in which we live and the world in which we live, it demands the existence of God. And for very good reasons. What I mean by this, to make sure I'm not misunderstood, is that when we consider the universe, we go back to one of the most basic and one of the most pivotal of questions that is asked from the youngest of ages. Where did it all come from? Where did all of these things come from in the first place? And you know, sometimes the most simple question and the most basic question is the right one. And that's the right one. That's how we begin to tackle this great and large subject this evening about the existence of God. And so when we ask the question, well, where did all of these things come from? We start to understand what is around us. And what do we see in the universe in which we live? What is the wonder of creation that faces us and confronts us every single day? Well, time doesn't allow me to go into all of the details, and probably I'm not qualified to go into all the details. But we all know one nursery rhyme that we learnt from the earliest of ages. And I'm not going to sing it to you because, unlike our brother this evening, I don't have a melodic voice, a destructive voice when it comes to songs, not a melodic one. But I know the words of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And don't start singing along with me. You just hold on and burst into song when you get home and before you go to bed at night. You know, how I wonder what you are. Simple words, aren't they? But they're quite profound when you think about them. We're caused to think about the stars in the night sky. And is there anything quite as glorious and majestic as the painted sky? As the stars in that night sky? That glisten, that tapestry, that sparkle and redound to the glory of a holy and a majestic God. It's one of the most recognizable and most loved of sights when we look at space and we contemplate the universe which is all around us. You know, in Genesis chapter 15, all of those years ago, it was God that brought Abraham out into the night sky and into the open plain. And he says, Abraham, look at the sky. And you think of Abraham's night sky there. It wasn't polluted by the street lamps, didn't have all of the home lights on. And there you had that incredible darkness. And you had a scattering of hundreds and thousands upon thousands of stars, all the constellations. And the Lord directs Abraham to see the stars. And he says, Abraham, can you number them? Can you count them? No, I can't count them. So shall your seed be, Abraham. And I will bless you in this measure. Do you know the Bible revealed the impossibility of numbering the stars long before scientists confirmed this fact with their long-range telescopes? In fact, if you go back to sort of ancient times and you look at ancient astronomers, there was one individual who initially documented just over 1,000 stars. I don't think he believed there was 1,000 stars, but that's all he could document himself. It's estimated to the visible eye there are possibly 10,000 stars that we can see depending on our vision and location on the earth. But with all of the advanced technology we have at our disposal and those incredible telescopes that we have, there is estimated over 100 billion stars. And where there are a possible, and with the possibility of galaxies outnumbering stars in our own galaxy, we enter into a figure of number of stars that is just mind-boggling. And you have to ask the question, where did these come from? And who put them there? Well, David in Psalm 8 verse 3, he says, when I consider these things, and he words it the heavens, and he says, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars. And he went on to say something quite crucial, which thou hast ordained. David knew. Where did it come from? You see, one of the most forceful and powerful arguments or persuasive statements that you can bring to someone who maybe is atheistic or someone that is unsure of these things is to do the very thing. Look at the stars. Tell me. Give me the origin of these things. How did this begin in the first place? Now, what you'll find when you engage in a conversation like this, if you speak to someone that is highly intelligent, someone that maybe has read many books, someone that is a very convinced atheist, someone that maybe feels they've got all of the arguments of science on their side, what they're going to do is they're going to tried to really baffle you and confuse you with a lot of technical statements, a lot of difficult statements, complex theorems, and so on. And you can do something in response. Every single one of us, we can do this one thing. You can reduce the question down to three possible explanations. And there aren't any more, unless you go into sort of the crazy realm of things don't actually exist, it's just your imagination. Well, I think we're all accepting the fact that's just not a plausible argument this evening. So for the origin of our universe, where everything came from, it boils down to three things. One of three answers. First of all, either everything, when we think of the universe, is self-created. So we understand what that means, it made itself. The second other option is this. It is self-existent, and that just means it has always been. It has forever been, it's eternal. It has no beginning, and maybe it has no end. Option one, it's a self-created universe. Option two, it's just always been. Option number three, it's created. Now, you search your minds and you search your thinking, are there any other options? Is there anything else we can throw into the mix? There really isn't. So can we eliminate the things? You can. You can eliminate one. And you know, even the secular scientist today has to confess they have to eliminate one. The ideas which may be gained, a lot of momentum in years which have gone by, are no longer accepted because it's been demonstrated and proven and shown without a shadow of a doubt that something cannot come from nothing. We've all heard of that theory of spontaneous generation, which of course had great popularity many years ago. In fact, it was something that was gradually developed over periods of centuries and many years. But it was soon put to bed and refuted, particularly by the well-known scientist Louis Pasteur and others, who demonstrated quite clearly from observable science that you cannot get something from nothing. And there is no such thing as spontaneous generation. And so even the secular scientists who reject the existence of God have to concede this evening that the universe did not make itself. Well, that leaves you with two options. It's either always been, or it's either been created by another, namely God himself. And if some will now side with the second option because they don't want the existence of God, and they say, okay, well, you as Christians, you say that God has always been. You'll find if you talk to an atheist who sort of maybe has looked into these things, that's what you're going to get. They're going to say to you, well, you believe that God has always existed. Why can't we believe the universe has always existed? Well, what do you say? How do you answer that particular question? The problem is that the same individuals that would espouse that type of thinking also have to accept that the general consensus of a secular scientific world is that the universe is that which is expanding, and if it's expanding, then it indicates it had a beginning. And if it had a beginning, it's not always existed. It cannot always exist. The alternative is to demand an eternally existing universe that somehow structured itself, formed itself, maintains itself, sustains itself, and brings us where we are. In other words, to hold to a notion that the universe has always existed is to attribute the attributes of God to the universe. You see the folly? Number one is easily dismissed, and even the atheists have to accept the fact that something doesn't come from nothing. Number two puts them into a conundrum, and it leaves us with one option. Everything is made. There is a creator. There is a mighty God. And I say to you that when we look at the existence of God, it's demanded. The universe demands it. Now, much more could be said on that, but I've tried to reduce that as simply and as clearly as I possibly can. But I encourage you to look more into it when you get time. But let's move on with our message this evening. Why is the existence of God denied? Why is it denied in the first place? It is often taught that those who are truly intelligent and scientific will not believe in a God. You'll hear people say that on occasions. Sometimes, you know, maybe if you are well-read or you like to have a good conversation, I've had people saying this to other Christians, sometimes people saying it to myself, and say, you seem like a reasonable person. You seem to know what you're talking about. You seem to have read a few, and you really believe in God, as if, you know, you can't think and believe at the same time. Well, that's nonsense. Thank God we can think and believe at the same time. And there's no contradiction in those two things. The misconception is that it's not possible to have faith and yet use reason. Nothing could be further from the truth. But for some, that's enough for them just to say, you know what, there's no God because, you know, it doesn't match with intelligence. Well, that's a bad argument. Others will come along and they will deny the existence of God because of trauma. Because of some dilemma in life, they've gone through a bad experience, they've gone through some difficulty, they may have gone through a Christian church, they may have encountered hypocrites, we've dealt with that on previous occasions, and they come to the conclusion, you know what, well, I see all these things, and so God cannot possibly exist. No, though, that's not evidence, that's just an argument or a reason not to believe. But when we search the scriptures, we actually get to the heart of the matter as to why the existence of God is denied. What is the core reason why people may even grow up and establish themselves in a view where they say, I do not believe that God exists? And while this is a hard thing to contemplate, I know it is, it's necessary. It's necessary as we come to the messages tomorrow and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. It's necessary as we come to consider our own responsibility before God himself. Why do men and women and young people come to a place in their life where they say, you know what, I do not believe there is no God, despite the demand for the existence of God all around them. And as we shall see at the end, the declaration of God's existence all around them. Why would they deny? I would say, first of all, it's a wishful denial. You say, well, what do you mean? Well, you can read Psalm 14. You can turn to it if you wish. It's a passage that you all know so well. Psalm 14, verse 1, David's psalm, he says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. It's interesting to think in David's time, people were saying the same things. As in our time, it's not anything new under the sun. I've always been interested by this verse because it's very telling. It's very insightful. The fool has said in his heart. Now, what does that mean when someone says something in their heart? The consensus there, as many commentators will treat that passage, is along these lines, that this is not a conviction of mind. It can't be. It can't be for reasons we've dealt with and reasons we shall deal with. But rather, it's a wishful want. It's a desire of the heart. It was Matthew Henry who said, this is not a person's judgment, but this is their imagination. They do not want God to exist. They do not like God to exist. And so they don't say in their minds, and they're not persuaded with their thoughts, but in their hearts they cry out, oh, there is no God. I don't want him. Why? Have you ever asked the question why? Why would a person, why would you, why would any of us this evening not want God to exist? Why? There's one word, isn't there? Accountability. And that strikes a terror in my heart. Accountability. Because if we attribute all of the attributes of God to the universe and say that there is no God, we're not accountable to the laws of gravity and physics. We're not held to account by the stars and the moon and the sun. But it's God who holds us account. You read the words of Paul in Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. I don't have time to go through them all, but he deals with those who are without excuse as to God's existence, his power, and his glory. And he goes on to say that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but they became vain and empty in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. You see, my friend, this evening, there is nothing quite as terrifying and troubling to realize that God knows me. All my thoughts, all my actions, all my sins, and there is nothing as terrifying and striking to the soul of men and women to realize, as the Bible makes abundantly clear, we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. Accountability. That's why the fool says, "No God." Because they don't want God. It's also a wicked denial, not just wishful. Psalm 14 draws the relationship. If you again read it in verse 1, the fool hath said in his heart, "There is no God." They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good. Now I can hear the objections. I know what everyone's going to say. You're going to get people saying, and maybe they're riled up by this, and they're maybe atheists by persuasion. In terms of society, they're good, decent people in the eyes of others. And they're going to say, "What? You're going to say that if I can't be an atheist and be good?" No, I'm not saying that. And the Bible doesn't teach that. In terms of, you know, people to people and neighbor to neighbor and so on. And then they'll say, "Oh, but there's plenty of people. They're Christians. And they're religious. Maybe they'll deal with other religions. And they do terrible things." Well, what is it that the psalm is saying here? It's this. The fruit of atheism will always lead to an abandonment of the basic moral law of God. Every time. Atheism is not the reasonable conclusion of a person who has come to prove there is no God. It's a worldview of one who wants there to be no God because there is an inherent, deep-seated want for sin. And they don't want to be disturbed. Because men, as Jesus makes clear, love darkness rather than light. That's the front reality. Why would a person deny the undeniable? Because it's God who holds us to account. Every one of us this evening. Now I'll finish with this last thought, and I trust that with it, it will encourage all who are saved this evening. Where is the existence of God declared? Well, you said, "Pastor, you've dealt with the night sky." That's for limitations. You're not a scientist. Well, they are my limitations to a certain extent, but I've got a little bit more for you this evening to encourage you. God's existence is declared throughout all creation. Well, we know the psalm, don't we? Psalm 19, verse 1, "The heavens declare the glory of God." It's not possible to look to that which is above and see the sun and moon and stars and to know all that we know and to factor in the earth's daily pattern, the tidal times, the sea. I mean, let's just stop there. Tidal times. We can go online and we can look ahead to a week. High tide, low tide, high tide, low tide. You don't wake up and go, what's the tide going to be like in Malile and Donaghadee? Oh, there's a tsunami tomorrow. These are regular patterns. These are structured, ordered designs. And we close our eyes to the very design of God all around us, everywhere. Seasons. I know it's coming to your favorite season. I know we love winter. We can't wait to get cold and for it then to rain and then winter drive down and then maybe the snow comes. Sometimes, and to my horror, it doesn't ever come in Newton Arts after waiting all these long years. But it moves on to the next season and the next season. And despite all the variations and little changes here and there, we have a God who gives us our seasons. And the birds that fly, and those little insects, and all of the details and features of a creation that we'll never have time to go into detail this evening. And God says, "They declare. They are my living sermons." And day after day, it utters speech, and there's no language where these things cannot be understood or heard. They declare my majesty and my glory. In many ways, one of the most distinct and powerful declarations regarding an infinitely intelligent, living, all-knowing God is all around you this evening. Look to your left and right. Look behind you, look in front of you. It's you. It's you and it's me. We make intelligent choices sometimes, I should probably add, on occasions. We make intelligent choices. We have faculties to think and consider and reflect. When someone's hurting, we cry. And when there is bereavement, we enter into their sorrow. We know how to love. We know what it is to rejoice with someone who is filled of jubilation and gladness and happiness. And whether people like to accept it or not, there is an instinct in us to worship. And when men and women have their backs against their wall, they pray. They pray. They will cry to God. As they consider the human frame, one of the things that has always been used to demonstrate the declaration of the glory of God is the human eye. The human eye. It's so wonderful. Proverbs 20, verse 12, the hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord hath made even both of them. It's often been said that Charles Darwin, even though still stoutly holding on to his evolutionary theories and thinking, even when it came to the human eye, he had to concede that the eye, with all of its complexities — he said a lot more, by the way, but I'm saving you some jargon this evening — with all of its complexities, to have been formed by natural selection seems absurd in the highest degree. Well, he's right, because it wasn't formed by natural selection. Recently, I saw some footage of a news report. And I forget the year, I think it was 2000 or something along those lines. And it was a newsreader, and he was out sort of in the streets, you know, when something happens in society and they're going around to people. And he's got one of the older forms of the mobile phones, you know, the first mobile phones that we had where you could only text or play a few little strange games on them. And they had huge aerials, and he had the sort of indestructible Nokia on those occasions. And he was talking about the rise of the mobile phone, and about how it had caught on and the sales and how it was sort of, you know, causing, you know, chaos across the world. As he closed the news report and was giving a detail about the wonderful mobile phone, he then threw something at the end, and he says, and coming very soon to mobile phones is the ability to take a photo and send it at a cost. But then he said, I don't think that's going to catch on. Well, obviously it caught on to a great extent. And we most of us have those not-so-smart phones where we can capture an image in a moment and send it on to another. But you know, you have a living camera in your very life, your eye, and you've got two of them. You've got two of them, and you don't have to pay £30 a month for them, unless you've got to do something with your eyes and your glasses. But you know what I mean. The human eye, it has a black interior to prevent light from scattering the iris. It has an automatic focusing lens. It has an adjustable diaphragm to control the light. It has a sophistical light-sensitive layer that adjusts to the wide range of brightness. And unlike any man-made camera, our retina can automatically change its sensitivity to brightness over a range of 10 billion to 1. There is nothing like it. It can repair itself. It can cleanse itself. It can wash itself. It converts images into electric signals that immediately are sent to the brain, where in less than a blink of an eye, the brain make all of the necessary adjustments to understand the image. I don't know, and that's just the eye, how anyone can contemplate that and say it made itself. It declares the glory of God. And as I close this evening, God's existence is declared at the cross. It's declared at the cross, dear friends. Remember Paul's great sermon as he stood on Mars Hill, or in the Greek, it's the Areopagus, And as he stands at Mars Hill, he's debating with the great philosophical minds of his day and age. The unknown God, I'm going to declare him unto you. And so he does. And as he gets to the end of that great passage, he speaks about that man whom God hath ordained. And what I want to say this evening is that the more a person considers the whole event surrounding the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, the more we understand the existence of God, every event that led up to it, every prophecy which is fulfilled, the unjust trial, the scorning, the ridiculing, the thieves either side, the cries from the cross, the responses, the miracles and the grounds which took place, and then his own cry and his own death and his own burial and his own resurrection, the impact of a crucified, risen Christ on the world, and ever since declares the design of a mighty God, because it can never be conjured up by the mind of limited men. God has done all this. Salvation is of the Lord. This evening, to deny the existence of God is not so much something that can be proven, but rather it's something that is wished and wanted for. It demonstrates not wisdom, but foolishness. Foolishness. We are in the presence of God. You sit and stand before God. The seeing eye and the hearing ear, he's made them. And we trust this week as we go to consider, has he spoken? What are we? Why is there suffering in this world? How can I be forgiven? Where do I spend eternity? They are the questions that matter. And it all begins here.